Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC Studios, I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast. It's Thursday, May 25th. So here we are on the precipice of a U.S. government default on paying its bills and providing its services, which the experts say would likely come in early June if the president and the Republican House of Representatives can't agree on terms for raising the debt ceiling, right? Most of the coverage right now is focusing on the negotiating positions of President Biden and Speaker of the House Kevin McCarthy. We'll start today a little differently, looking mostly in some detail at what default might actually entail, who gets hurt, how, and how quickly. We will get into the negotiations too, which are at a very interesting point right now, with both sides reportedly ready for some compromises, but also some new Republican demands. My guest for this is Jeff Stein, White House economics reporter for The Washington Post. Since joining the Post in November 2017, he has covered the Republican tax law, the government shutdown, and the administration's economic response to the coronavirus, among other topics. He has an article ominously titled, Seven Doomsday Scenarios if the U.S. Crashes Through the Debt Ceiling. Jeff, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
My pleasure as a New Yorker at heart, so thanks so much for having me on.
First, this June 1st date we've all been keying on, it's more accurately as early as June 1st, I think, and different experts are predicting different dates for actual default, but are they all landing on sometime in the first half of June?
Yeah, so tax revenue and tax payments are notoriously volatile. It's very hard to predict precisely how much will go out or come into the U.S. Treasury every day or every week. And so that's created this quite unfortunate situation where lawmakers on Capitol Hill don't know exactly what the drop dead deadline is. And it's created this a little bit of uncertainty. Our best guess right now is probably June 8th, June 9th, in that range. But what Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said is that she cannot guarantee that the U.S. government will not default anytime after June 1st.
And you reported on Treasury Secretary Yellen asking federal agencies if they can delay payments for a while without cutting the actual services. Any agencies that are most important to that? And how would that delay the so-called X date?
Well, so what we reported is that the Treasury Department sent out this memo to the federal agencies. And it's important to be clear here. What they were not saying was, take, you know, some payments and see if you cannot make them. What they were saying is, what flexibility might you have legally without any impact to services to, if a bill could be made, you know, could be paid, I guess, between Wednesday and next Tuesday. If there's no impact otherwise, maybe we'll make it next Tuesday to give us a little bit more breathing room. This is, and I think it set off a bit of a hilarious response on Twitter when I pointed this out. It's really like just managing your checking account day to day and seeing what payments you can put off a little bit.
Yeah, gee, the government, just like us regular folks. An article by your Washington Post colleague, Amber Phillips, says, if the government defaults, it would not be pretty. The words in the title. It would not be able to borrow money to pay for Social Security, issue tax refunds, or pay the salaries of federal workers and members of the military. So that's pretty dire. Would all that happen at once on X date plus one?
That's a great question, because when you talk to economists about this, what they really stress is the degree, the severity of the impact, the financial harm from a default really magnifies, really grows the longer this goes on. And so I'll just say quickly, when we had the 2011 debt ceiling standoff under President Obama, the stock market fell by close to 20%, and that was without a default, right? So what happens if we're in a scenario where not only do we get close to the precipice, but we go beyond it possibly for weeks, which I don't think is likely, but in that scenario, that's why we call it a doomsday scenario, the U.S. government is the foundation of the U.S. economy, and the U.S. economy is the foundation of the global economy. And so much of economics is psychological. And what you would really see is a worldwide crisis of confidence. The White House has estimated more than 8 million jobs could be lost. We've been looking at projections that suggest an economic contraction on the level of the Great Recession. We've seen estimates of 45% or more decline in stock values and $3 or $4 trillion in lost household net worth. These are obviously terrifying numbers. If we get to the impasse and they resolve it, or they go a little bit beyond, maybe, you know, these will sound hyperbolic in retrospect, but This is the magnitude of the scale of the problem we're looking at.
Let's take a phone call. Here's Robert in Brooklyn, who has, I think, a basic question. Robert, you're on WNYC. Hi there.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I keep hearing on the news on TV the Republicans are demanding deep cuts in Medicare, Medicaid, and food stamps. With regard specifically to Medicaid and food stamps, they're demanding work requirements, but they don't specify on TV who would be required to work. Would it apply across the board for work requirements? Or would it be just, would anybody be exempt, like senior citizens or people with children? Or, again, it's mainly about Medicaid and food stamps.
Robert, thank you very much. So that's one of the negotiating positions of Speaker Kevin McCarthy. This is not on a scenario if a default actually happens, but we are talking about the negotiations too. So, Jeff, do you know the answer to Robert's question about the work requirements that McCarthy wants?
Yeah, so on the question of Medicaid, President Biden and the Democrats I have talked to have been extremely adamant as a red line that they will not accept new work requirements on Medicaid. I believe the Republicans have essentially proposed allowing states to tighten them. So if you're in a blue state, you're less likely to be exposed to that. But this is something I've been focusing on less, because everything I hear from the negotiators is that that is not an option. That is not going to happen. However, the White House has been open quietly to the idea of work requirements on food stamps. And my understanding of what they've discussed primarily is, you know, primarily either more sort of strict requirements around sort of paperwork, to basically require people to fill more paperwork to prove that they're looking for work, because there are some existing food stamp work requirements, and then separately changing some of the age eligibility. This is a bit of a pop quiz for me, so I'm doing my best, but my recollection is that, you know, it only applies to people of a certain age bracket, and they could maybe expand that, so more people who are slightly older would also be exposed to work requirements. I think that actually is a part of active discussion right now, but we don't know exactly where this will go at the end of the day. I will say, you know, it is the case that Republicans have pushed quite strenuously for Medicaid work requirements. So even though it's not going to be in the deal, that is something certainly the party stands for.
Here's a question that has come in via text. And this text, Jeff, asks, why do they have to borrow to make Social Security payments? And it's a good question. You know, it's like, are we that out of money? Like on June 1st or whatever the X date actually turns out to be, the government has $0?
It is a great question. And I think in the event that we actually hit a default, depending on what the Treasury Secretary wanted to do, you would have some very difficult choices because, right, the U.S. bond, the government debt, the debt that the U.S. has issued is such a safe asset that it has really become sort of the building block of the global economy. Investors worldwide, countries around the world, they use this as a safe asset, as a reserve asset to sort of build their financial portfolios. And so the fear is that if we miss a payment on the bond, you could trigger a collapse in the global economy. And when pitted against the prospect of not making Social Security payments, maybe that takes precedence. I'm not saying anyone at the administration has said that. I'm saying that's a one potential calculation that someone could make. That said, you know, the amount of revenue in especially the first few days of a default would be probably enough to make most Social Security payments. I think another interesting wrinkle to this is that I actually got curious of, because I didn't understand it, you know, just a few days ago when I was trying to understand this question, is, right, the Social Security and Medicare programs are run as trust funds, and you and I, right, we pay money out of our paychecks every 2 weeks or whatever to the trust funds. So my question was, why would payments be impacted when our money is already going sort of separate to the Treasury Department? But this is not actually how the programs work in practice. They actually take the money that we send to them and they convert it into Treasury bonds. And every time the Treasury, every time Social Security or Medicare send out money for benefits, what actually happens is the Treasury Department is basically redeeming the bonds that are held by the trust fund. So it's not like the money we are spending, you know, or paying via tax collection to the trust funds actually ends up directly in the trust funds and are just there waiting to be reapportioned to people's benefits.
To the negotiations, you report that after refusing to negotiate for months, President Biden's aides last week did offer substantial concessions on the federal budget, including a freeze on spending for 2 years that nonpartisan estimates have projected could cut deficits by as much as $1 trillion over the next decade. So that's pretty big. And you report House Republicans do appear willing to drop some of their demands, especially a call for Biden to abandon his student loan forgiveness program. And they did want him to cancel some green energy tax credits. But you report they're also determined to push for more concessions that weren't even in that original Inflation Reduction Act legislation. So what are some of those new Republicans' demands that you're reporting, and how do you see the state of the negotiations?
Yeah, so the new demands really are on the work requirements for SNAP that we discussed earlier for food stamps. So in terms of the state of negotiations, I want to just kind of briefly explain what's going on, because it does sound like a lot, right? Like $1 trillion over 10 years from a spending freeze. And the Republican perspective is that that's not good enough, because the majority of those savings, the deficit reduction from the 1 year or 2 year spending freeze, come from year 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, where if we hold spending in place for year one and year two, then every subsequent year, you're pocketing the difference between what it would have been and how it's rising. And so Republicans are saying, well, we are not okay with merely keeping spending in place. We want an actual reduction. Like that's kind of their line. We have this uncontrollable spending and debt problem. We want to spend less money. McCarthy has said this a dozen times, if not more. We want less spending next year than this year. And a freeze doesn't do that, which they're correct about. However, from the Democratic perspective, this seems like an outrageous ask, and I'll tell you why. It's because they are supplementing their desire for an overall spending cut with a simultaneous desire and demand that the government spend more money on the military, on border security, and on veterans. And when you do that, when you shelve off veterans and those three programs from cuts, what you are essentially doing is for the overall number to still go down by 1%, you're requiring everything else in this part of the federal budget
to go down that much more. So you're telling us McCarthy is calling for more spending for his favorite programs while publicly saying this is all about spending less. And I hear you, that estimate 8 to 12% of cuts from the other programs. So a listener texts, why not discussion about the flip side of debt, tax cuts these past 50 years is what the texter says. But what about just the Trump tax cuts for the rich? That, of course, contributes to the deficit as well and the accumulated debt, because the government gets less revenue. And obviously, McCarthy doesn't want that. But any chance that some kind of rollback of the tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans will wind up in the final version of whatever they negotiate?
Yeah, I had an exclusive on this question late last week, where White House negotiators who I think really are looking at a deal that most Democrats are going to despise because of the cuts to vital programs, nutrition assistance for poor mothers and rental aid for people in cities and all these programs that they're desperate not to cut. They came to Republicans last week and said, can we please get not even the rollback of the Trump tax cuts, which they knew not to ask for, but really, really, really small, I think it's fair to say, tweaks that what, you know, even nonpartisan tax experts would call loopholes. And this is like changing the time horizon for when crypto investors can claim deductions from losses on their crypto investments. Like, that was the kind of thing, like a few billion dollars in a deal that involves trillions of dollars. And they came up with, we reported last week, a list of 12 of these demands. And Republicans just said, no, we're not doing that. And I think the frustration for Democrats is that this is a unlevel playing field where the Republicans are okay with the brinksmanship over the federal debt limit that could have such horrific consequences. And the Democrats are in a bind because they, you know, they're choosing to, you know, entertain these cuts rather than default. And really, like, we asked some of McCarthy's top lieutenants, what are Democrats getting in these negotiations, which I think gets to the listener's question. And their answer was the debt ceiling, like, that this doesn't get blown up.
Right. So that's not a policy or a tax and spend item similar to what McCarthy is asking for. One more call. Wendy in Springfield, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hi, Wendy.
Hi. I have not done any research on these negotiations because they should not be happening. President Biden had a meeting with historians, and he asked them, how do I have a significant presidency like FDR or LBJ? They said bold moves will do it, not incremental. Pay the bills. Forget this, right? You do not negotiate on this. Over the years, as the other person said, the Republicans raise the debt, and then the Democrats bring it down. The Republicans raise the debt, and the Democrats bring it down. So this is all about destroying his presidency. I've called my senators and my congressperson, and the White House comments line was not open yesterday temporarily, but it's 202-456-1111. It's available from 11 to 3, Tuesday to Thursday. Call everybody and tell them to pay the bills. Okay, he gets sued. Go ahead, sue me. I'm going to pay the bills. All right, let's see what happens. Do a bold move. That's the only thing that will work.
Wendy, thank you very much. And I think Wendy is specifically referring to this idea that the 14th Amendment, a particular clause in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, enables Biden to order the bills to be paid, to order the debt ceiling to be risen, to meet the bills that the government has incurred without going through Kevin McCarthy, without going through Congress at all. Later in the show, we're going to have a constitutional law expert, Professor Stephen Vladeck from the University of Texas. And one of the things we're going to ask him about is his take on the 14th Amendment and whether Biden can actually do that. You're not a constitutional law expert. You're an economics reporter for the Washington Post, but you're also following the politics of this. Might Biden invoke the 14th Amendment and let the chips fall where they may in court?
I actually think this, even though it seems like a legal question, it actually is kind of an economics question. And so I want to be very clear in this response that I am not coming down on one side of the debate. But what I can tell you, what my sources inside the administration and economists close to the administration have explained to me, because to the listener's point, like, a lot of Democrats are furious that, like, they have to entertain these draconian cuts because of this unilateral weird sort of quirk of the U.S. Legislative system. And so what the economists are, what the administration is saying is that even though they might think that they are on safe legal grounds, that the 14th Amendment is clear, that they can continue to pay their bills and must continue to pay their bills rather than default, what they're worried about is that the economics of proceeding with the 14th Amendment almost has as severe financial consequences as defaulting on the debt. And the reason that is because you sort of have to understand the mechanics of what's going on here, which is that the U.S. government, in the event of a 14th Amendment invocation, would simply go ahead and issue debt. This is the core question, right? What will happen to the debt issuance? If the U.S. government were to issue debt, without the approval of Congress, what would happen? And that's the situation nobody knows. But the fear among White House officials is that if they go forward with that, investors will still demand a premium on the uncertainty, on the legally dubious debt insurance.
That's the key word, right?
Because and even if the White House thinks that it's legitimate.
Uncertainty makes markets freak out. And this would be such massive uncertainty that it might make markets freak out, is really what you're saying, right?
The premium that investors would demand, in theory, on debt that Republicans in the Supreme Court are vowing to overturn, right? Like if you're buying a government bond and it pays back a 1% rate, what rate would you insist on if there's a 30% chance that the courts will invalidate that that bond? So that could raise the interest rate to 3, 4, 5, who knows, right? And so the thinking in the White House is that, maybe if our back is up against the wall and we're really at the precipice, maybe we try this. But until then, it's worse than like a Hail Mary, I don't know what the right metaphor is here.
Right. But, really, really interesting economics answer to what I thought was a legal question. And there we're out of time. So thanks, Jeff. You've been really, really informative. I enjoyed this. I think our listeners did. Jeff Stein, White House economics correspondent for The Washington Post on these default scenarios and the negotiations to avoid them. Jeff, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to get much more substantive questions than I do on TV.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.